Hi, this is Dennis Calero. I'm the artist on the Casino Royale graphic novel from Dynamite Comics, and you are listening to On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast.
Hello and welcome to On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast. We've got another very special episode today. We have with us the artist from the newly released Casino Royale graphic novel from Dynamite Comics, the very talented Dennis Calero. Welcome to the show, Dennis.
Thank you for having me. Hi, everybody.
We are excited to have you here. I know I pre-ordered this book and it came in a few days ago. And
Looks
great, dude. It looks
fantastic. Oh, I'm so happy you feel that way. Thank you.
Yes.
There's a lot of work.
Okay.
I don't mind my saying. It was a lot of work.
Okay. Even though this is early, we usually kick off with the bomb basics, but since you mentioned that, let me just jump in right now and ask you, how long did it take?
A little over a year. It was 155 pages of black and white art. I didn't color it, otherwise it would have taken longer. But yeah, over a year to adapt the book. We were very close to the text of the novel. I mean, we cut out very, very little, only basically what we had to. And so it is the definitive adaptation of the original novel by Ian Fleming.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's wonderful. You guys did a great job.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, we're proud.
I feel like you probably carried Van a little bit. I'm just kidding. I just say that because he's not here. That's the rule of podcasting. If they're not here,
right. He's not here to defend himself. That's right. Van had the unenviable. I mean, enviable in terms of, you know, who doesn't want to work with James Bond? He's one of the preeminent characters in the history of literature. But the job came with a lot of provisos and restrictions. Ian Fleming Publications was very helpful in keeping us. They were very hands off in terms of our sort of creative choices. They were a resource. They were sort of there demanding that we were very close to the text and very faithful to the text, but they were also incredibly helpful and generous with their time in terms of providing us the information that we needed and the resources we needed to keep the graphic novel accurate. It cannot be said enough because these are guys and gals who are every day they're dealing with a plethora of licensing material from customized sports cars, suits,
right,
perfumes, lighters. You know, I was in Harrods in London and I saw a really boss 007 lighter with the gun barrel shape drilled through the lighter.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, I got to have that. It was like $6,000. I'm like, 6,000 pounds. I'm like, I don't have to have that.
No, I don't.
But these guys are handling all of this material, and comics are very intense creative processes and require a lot of attention, and they worked extra hours, so my thanks go out to them for helping us. But it was a very, you know, Van took those resources and made a terrific script, which was a pleasure to draw.
Awesome. Let's jump in and get some of your Bond basics, just because, you know, all of our listeners Bond fans, so we got to find out what kind of a Bond fan you are. So I'm going to run you through a series of basic questions, and
okay,
like we tell everybody, don't get nervous, there's no right or wrong answers, but everyone is silently judging you.
That's why I thrive. Thank you.
All right, Dennis, what's your first memory of Bond? Like, how did you step into the James Bond universe?
Oh, a very vivid memory. I remember walking out of my upteenth viewing of Star Wars and seeing the poster. Now, I could be conflating two memories, but these memories are linked in my mind. Walking out of Star Wars and seeing the poster for Moonraker. Now, I'm fairly sure what happened. I was so young, because I'm such a young man. So very young.
Okay.
But back before VCRs were common and videotapes were still expensive, back in the ancient days, theaters used to have revivals. If a movie was popular, they might bring that movie back the next year or the year after that for people to come see it again and pay more money. So I'm fairly sure it was one of these secondary runs or tertiary runs of Star Wars. But I walk out and here is this other space poster for this movie called Moonraker, with this really cool looking guy pointing a laser gun in a spacesuit. And I'm like, oh, this must be just like Star Wars. So they fooled me. They got me.
The marketing machine worked. That's right.
The marketing machine, they focused on me. And they're like, these little, can you curse on this podcast or is that verboten?
You go right ahead. We'll take care of anything.
They're like, these little bastards, they love the Star Wars movie. And we're going to get them. And they got me. It worked. But I very quickly realized that this is not a Star Wars movie. This is not a science fiction movie. But I fell in love with Roger Moore and the cheekiness and the spy craft. And I fell in love with Bond. And so that was my first memory. Yes, so there you go.
One of my early memories is tied to Moonraker as well. My older brother had the trading cards.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah. And, used to make that.
Yeah, I actually own a full set now. I'm proud of that.
Wow.
But
wow, that's cool. That's boss.
The Moonraker was kind of on flipping through those trading cards. And my first theater experience was Octopussy. So I'm not
too far. Well, there you go. Yeah, not too far.
But anyway, we're not here talking about me. Talk about you. Who's your favorite Bond actor?
Timothy Dalton, hands down.
Yes. Yeah, I hope hands you're, down, you're not being sarcastic.
Hands down. No, not at all. Hands
okay,
down,
yes.
He is my favorite. Tim did a great job. Like we're personal friends, Tim. He did a great job. I felt that in both his forays to this day, I'll frame it in terms of context. By the time that View to a Kill came out, I was still a fan. I still love that movie. But I definitely felt at the time that, okay, Roger Moore is great. I'm a big fan. I grew up with Roger Moore. He's my Bond. But it's getting a little old by now. And it's time to, you know, pass it on. So the prospect of having a younger action-oriented star in a Bond film was incredibly exciting to me to go into the sort of different era, because I'd never really experienced that. By the time Moonraker and For Your Eyes Only is a great film, but by that time, there's a lot of insert shots and there's a lot of stuntmen doing the stunts. Didn't feel contemporary, didn't feel as exciting as, you know, Die Hard and Lethal Weapon and some of these other movies that were coming out at the time. And so the prospect of this was great. And then to find that the actor was someone that was really well versed, steeped in the Fleming universe and respected the character, respected the novels and wanted to bring a touch of that. So when I saw Living Daylights, even though in retrospective, it's still a little, you know, it's not that different in terms of campiness to what came before. It was just sort of a marginal shift in a certain direction. But that was enough to really excite me and make me feel like, okay, like here's a Bond that I can really get behind as I'm getting a little older and I'm more interested in sort of more sophisticated action entertainment. He was great. And not to mention, he's just a terrific actor, and he really just sold the character for me. It's a real shame. It's a real shame that he only got to do two of them, you know, for all those legal reasons, which I'm sure those pitfalls your audience, I'm sure they're familiar with, McClory and all that other stuff. Didn't get to do any more, but at least we have those two. And so he is my personal favorite Bond.
Oh, you and I are in 100% agreement. He's mine as well.
There you go. I mean, in Living Daylights, when the spotlight, after he supposedly assassinates the KGB, head of the KGB, and that spotlight hits him and he just turns really fast and shoots the spotlight out, yeah. I'm like, that's the Bond that I've always seen in my head. Also, because by that time, I'd also read a few of the books. So I knew by then, okay, and I'd seen some of the Connery ones, and I knew that, okay, so what we're getting with the later Roger Moore ones, as fun as much as I can appreciate them now, in terms of a hue in the rainbow spectrum of the Bond actors, I appreciate all of them for different reasons. It was terrific to see up to that point what I felt had been the closest contemporary version of Ian Fleming's character to date. So there you go.
Absolutely agree with you. I'm a big Tim Dalton fan myself. Good answer.
There you go.
That was absolutely correct.
Thank you.
What's your favorite Bond movie?
I don't think I can pick a favorite. I love all of them, and I love a group of them for different reasons. I'll give you my – I believe that every Bond actor – had at least one superlative Bond, every single one.
I agree.
So I'll go through that if that's okay with you.
Let's do it.
Connery from Russian with Love.
Yeah.
To me, that's a perfect Bond movie to me. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, terrific Bond film. I feel like George Lazenby, I think he could have grown into the character. I think there's a definite possibility he could have grown into the character and become a better actor. But for the first time out, for someone that had never really acted before, and to have the benefit of such a terrific script, terrific. For Your Eyes Only, which is one of the later Bonds where the Moore Bonds where you got to see him kick a little ass. And that scene where he just gets mad at the guy for killing that chick and he kicks the car over the cliff.
Yes.
For just being a jerk. I love that. There was a flash of that Ian Fleming Bond that we had often missed with Moore. I'm going to pick Living Daylights out of the two Dalton ones. I think that one holds together the best out of the two. GoldenEye. Terrific Bond film, and I wish the rest of the Brosnan. I wish he had been given material. Brosnan, if you think about it, for me, Brosnan is kind of like the perfect apotheosis of all the Bonds. He's very, very suave. He's a bit cheeky. He can be rough, and you can believe a certain amount of the cruelty that we want and toughness that we want in a Bond. I just think that after GoldenEye, by and large, the material just wasn't very good. So it's a shame that he didn't get to do better stuff. But GoldenEye is a terrific Bond, and Casino Royale. At any given day, I might pick Casino as my favorite of the film Bond. You know, obviously because it's modern and it's very close to the novel in its own way. I knew that Daniel Craig would be a great Bond after I saw a movie called Archangel. He played a historian who becomes an English historian who becomes embroiled in the Russian monarchy. And it's very Bondish without actually being, but he never picks up a gun, I don't think. But he's very Bondian.
Okay.
And even though people say, oh, it was Lehrkick. I don't see Bond in his performance in Lehrkick. I don't know how you feel about that. I don't see Bond in that performance. It's kind of hard for me to believe, and I've had this argument many times. it's hard for me to believe that someone in the Broccoli family didn't see Archangel, because he's so obviously Bond there. Yeah, so Casino. So there you go. So those are my – I think that's five, right?
Thank you. Five. Rounded out nicely.
Any given day, I might – any one of those might be my favorite.
Yeah, I kind of in the same vein. I tell everybody, like, Goldfinger, For Your Eyes Only – and I'm a License to Kill guy. When the wind blows.
License to Kill is great. License to Kill is great.
I like a revenge film, and I like seeing Bond straight up revenge. But anyways, yes,
yeah.
I like your list. I think it's very solid.
Thank you.
It's
a lot of fun stuff in License to Kill from the Live and Let Die, the novel.
The novel,
which was nice to see. And this was I was young, very young when I saw that movie. I had read Live and Let Die by then. And I was just like, wait a minute, why is this stuff? But it's not, but it is. I didn't know how Hollywood worked and how you things are a mishmash and you grab from things. But it was it's fun to see that material there. And it's rough. You get a great performance by Benicio del Toro. Mm-hmm. He's terrific in that. I think his first film role.
Yeah.
And boy, it's rough. It's rough when they do the lighter in that. They're not joking around.
They are not.
Good flick. Good flick.
Yeah,
for sure.
That's probably a lot of the influence of what you mentioned earlier. You know, like the Lethal Weapons and stuff. They wanted that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We're going on a movie tangent, but for sure, I think that they were definitely responding to the Lethal Weapons, and it's interesting the flack that Dalton got at the time. The Resistance, especially in light of how embraced Daniel Craig's films were later, and I just think that people have trouble making adjustments. I think people just, you know, it was such a whiplash from A View to a Kill to Living Daylights. Mm-hmm. At least it must have seemed at the time. I mean, really, if you watch one then the other, the tone really isn't all that different. But what's also just, and we can stop talking about the movies, but what's interesting to me is same director directed GoldenEye, directed Casino Royale, and tonally they're such different films. It just goes to show you how just some slight adjustments can really just change the perception of the character. Very
Absolutely.
Interesting to me.
Absolutely. Well, we're not getting off films just yet, because now I need to know who your favorite Bond villain is.
Oh, okay. So books or movies?
Movies.
Or either.
Or whatever.
Movies, okay.
You know, whatever you feel. That's fine. Whatever you think.
Let me think. I'll pick two. I have a soft spot in my heart for Drax.
Okay.
Because he was in Moonraker, and the actor really is, like, he sort of hammed it up, but in a very, you could almost imagine he was real. He's almost like the guy that owns Virgin Atlantic.
Yeah.
You almost feel like that vibe off of him. And I think he was very much that kind of a character in the book. So I love that. But I also love Le Chiffre. I think Le Chiffre in Casino Royale was just really understated and just a lot of fun.
Very captivating performance by Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah, he was great. He's terrific.
Super. Yeah. What about henchmen? Every villain's got a henchman. Who's your favorite?
Jeez, I mean, you know, you got to try to struggle to get away from Jaws and Odd Job.
Right?
They're the obvious, choices. But Nick Knack is great.
Yes,
I personally love Teehee.
Yes,
boy, who would you consider the henchmen in the Craig film? I know Batista was one.
Yeah, he's
and
kind of popular.
I wish he'd been given more to do. I felt like we could have gotten more out of him. There wasn't really one in Skyfall. Really, I'm trying to think. Casino, there wasn't.
They had that guy that Bond blew up out on the airfield. He was
He's kind of lame.
But he didn't make it to the end of the movie.
No. Is there a henchman in Quantum of Solace? Not really. The general.
Try not to think about it.
See, I got to tell you, just another side note. I hope your audience finds this. You can just edit this out if your audience doesn't like it. If I watch Quantum right after I watch Casino, Quantum is terrific. Terrific. Because it's really – the problem with Quantum is that it's a coda. It doesn't really stand on its own. It really is – only exists to be a continuation of Casino. It's almost like a 2-hour extra scenes, like oh no, not the extra scenes. What do they call the Marvel movies when they do the add-on?
Oh yeah, like the after credits type of.
Yeah, it's Quantum of Solace is a 2-hour after credits sequence, and it's hilarious how that is.
I think you've explained that better than I've ever heard it explained before.
Yeah, from that point of view, it's terrific. It's got a lot of great sequences. Craig is great. A lot of great stunts. The opening car chase is terrific. I like that director. I like what he did with World War Z. I think he's a very sort of lean and mean type of director. Mm-hmm. Not for everything, but for certain kinds of films, I think he's great. So I don't slam. Quantum. Let me think. I'm gonna say Knick Knack.
I
like Knick Knack. He's small, but he's still just kicking ass left and right, and you gotta admire that. It's great.
Yeah,
it's
for a tiny guy, he caused a ton of problems.
A lot of problems. Yeah, I love that about him, and of course, a great performance, a really memorable performance in a film that's okay. Mm-hmm. He stands out. So there you go.
Nothing wrong with that. Let's talk Bond girls. And at this point, we usually offer up to the person being interviewed, you pick your favorite Bond girl. You can pick one for character. And if you just want to get down to your baser instincts, you can
pick
one for that, too.
You know what? I got to say, they're all wonderful. But Femke Johnson, that's the one that does it for me. Character and actress, the whole thing, the whole package.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's the one. She's the one for me.
No, I like the no hesitation on that.
That was easy. That was easy.
All right.
On a top. That's the best.
Let's talk about the movie soundtracks and scores. Do you have one that stands out that you particularly enjoy?
Let me see. You know, I played the crap out of the Living Daylights soundtrack and score. I'm a big A-ha fan, actually. It was a thrill to have them do that song, and I love the score, and I love the Pretenders on that album as well. No, I'm not a huge Pretenders fan. For some reason, I think everything they did on that album is great.
I agree.
So I'd probably put that as my favorite overall Bond score album. In terms of the favorite song, it's probably between View to a Kill, Living Daylights, and You Know My Name. It's probably between those three. Those are all great songs.
You've got some unique picks that I completely agree with, though. Those are great.
Thank you. Live and Let Die, a fourth.
All right. Nothing wrong with that. Just saw a 35mm screening of Live and Let Die with my son this week. It was a lot of fun. We went out and did that.
That's a good one.
It's a fun film. So getting into the books, do you have a favorite book? You read a lot of them, or?
Yeah, in terms of I've read all the Flemings, and I've read a lot of the pastiches. I've read a lot of the ones that other authors have taken up. In terms of the original books, I'm going to pick either Casino or From Russia with Love. I think From Russia with Love is it's a great story, and it's superlative writing. I mean, Fleming was really a really great wordsmith. The book is really transporting, so I think I'll pick that one. And I'll give your readers a couple of, in case they don't catch these non-Fleming novels, a couple of recommendations. I think that Trigger Mortis is terrific. It's a great book, and I love the title. It's an outlandish title that apparently actually comes from a real thing. Apparently, NASA in the 50s and 60s, when they were launching the first experimental rockets, there was a kill switch on all the rockets in case the rocket was going the wrong direction. They were afraid it was going to hurt people. And it was called Trigger Mortis, which is there is no other non-Fleming Bond title better than that. That is an amazing, and it's a terrific, terrific book. David Alyoejo, I'm massacring that name, but he played Martin Luther King Jr. He does the voice for Bond. He narrates the audiobook. Okay. And I recommend, he is a terrific, people talk about a black Bond. There's my black Bond, because he is absolutely terrific. He does Bond terrific. He does all the characters terrific. The villain is a North Korean character. He does that voice terrific. He's completely convincing, and the audiobook is completely immersive. It's great. And the other one I can recommend is Solo. And both of these books are, my understanding is that there's like separate lines of Bond, new Bond novels now. Some are sort of set contemporary, with Bond having been a veteran of the Gulf War, et cetera, et cetera. And then these novels that I've been talking about, these two novels are both set in the original timeline of the Fleming novel. So one, I believe, takes place just after Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one takes place after The Spy Who Loved Me, I believe. So it's fun. There's references. Pussy Galore makes an appearance earlier in one of the novels before she exits. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, so there you go.
Excellent.
I say there you go a lot.
That's quite all right. I say excellent a lot, so we're going to be fine.
There you go.
Excellent. So what about the realm of 007 in games, be it RPGs, board games, video games? You ever dabble in any of that?
Oh, yeah. I'm an old school James Bond RPG role player from the 80s.
Yeah.
Got a lot of those things. Those are a lot of fun.
Yes.
I love the cover art for all those games where it was like Roger Moore, but not quite, so we don't get sued. It was terrific. And I played a lot of GoldenEye like everybody else. And then I believe I did play Everything or Nothing, which I think has the best best Bond song outside of the films.
I think you're right.
A lot. That song is fun. There was a song added to one of the audiobook adaptations of one of the pastiche novels, and it was I won't say which one it is, but it was not good. It was not good, but that Everything or Nothing, that's pretty great.
Yeah, man. I'm thinking we should hang out more in our spare time.
I live this stuff.
Yeah,
that's my that's my guy.
That brings us to the end of our Bond basics round. And even though I told you there were no right and wrong answers, I lied, and you got a lot of them right, though, so that's good.
That's good.
That's excellent. So let's get into the comics. You talked a little bit about the comic creation at the front end because I couldn't help myself. I had to get into that. Now, had you read? It sounds like you probably have. It sounds like you're very steeped into it. Had you read any of the other Bond comics before you got into?
No, absolutely. Bond existed as a, as I'm sure you know. Bond existed as a comic strip even before the first film, before Dr. No.
That's right.
And in fact, my understanding, and this could be apocryphal, but my understanding, the legend is that Cubby Broccoli was a fan of these strips. And then when he saw Sean Connery, he felt that like the drawing by one of the artists, which the name will come to me any second now, he felt that his rendition of Bond looked a lot like Sean Connery, or Sean Connery, vice versa. Sean Connery looked a lot like the rendition of this drawing by Lawrence. That's his last name. So I've got all those collected through the Titan editions. Titan Comics does wonderful editions illustrated by Jim Lawrence. And the other artist who I prefer is actually Yaroslav Horak, who did it. This strip went on into well into the 80s. I think 30 or almost 40 years of continuous publication. So I'm very familiar with those. And there was a DC Comics adaptation of Dr. No that doesn't look like anything.
It's from Showcase. Showcase.
But I love those original comic strips. I have the whole thing collected. The thing about those is that because they're comic strips, they're very, very abbreviated.
Right.
And the standard structure of a comic strip is if it's three or four panels, is the first panel usually resets the stage. It resets whatever the stakes were the last time we saw these characters or from the last strip. And the last one's a cliffhanger. So you really only have one or two panels to move the story forward. So if you're reading it as a graphic novel, if you're reading it as sort of one continuous sitting experience, then it feels very start-stoppy. Mm. And so what we were doing was something that was different in terms of a comparative between the two reading experiences.
I tell you what, if you don't already have it, I'm going to recommend this to you and to our listening audience. My usual co-host on these episodes is Alan J. Porter. And Alan is in England right now, so he couldn't be here today. Alan wrote a book called The Art of James Bond, The History of the Illustrated 007.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. No, I have not heard of this.
It is the most comprehensive compilation of Bond in comics you'll ever find.
Oh, my goodness.
History of the Illustrated 007 by Alan J. Porter. Available on Amazon. It's awesome. I highly recommend it. It sounds like you'd be really into it.
I will buy a copy. I hope he revises it soon with our material.
I think he's going to need to. I think we just put the pressure on him. But, oh, it's a great it's a great book. Now, speaking of your material, what was the kind of the road that led you to this project, a Casino Royale, the graphic novel for Dynamite?
Well, actually, you know, I'd spoken to someone that was working with the Fleming family, the publication company, quite a few years ago. I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago at this point. And this person was interested in getting the rights and having these things done for an American market and actually for a world market. Mm-hmm. That didn't work out as often as the case. I did a couple sample pages and then didn't hear anything about it, which happens a lot in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And as, you know, in all kinds of entertainment fare, that's fairly common. So comes to be that a publishing company that I'm very familiar with, who I'm friendly with and was doing a lot of work for at one point, Dynamite Comics, Dynamite Entertainment, Nick Barucci and Joe Rybrandt had procured the rights through some sort of miraculous kismet. The Flemings pulled out at one point one of my sample pages and said, "Can we get this guy?" And they basically, after some rigmarole, they said, you know, long story short, they said, yeah, well, yeah, we can get that guy. So they got me, and that was it. So after 4 or 5 years after doing this initial sample, I'm being given this job to do. And so that was – it's fun because it hurt to lose that one there. I try not to get too attached to – there are people that are like, well, I got to draw Batman. I want to draw Spider-Man no matter – just let me do it. I don't care, you know, what you pay me. Mm-hmm. I've never been one of those guys. They're kind of, you know, some projects are more interesting than others. That's the nature of the beast. If I'm drawing and painting or writing and making a living, I'm happy. Every once in a while, it is nice to be able to look up on a shelf and see one of the characters that you know, idolized as a child and say, well, I've made some sort of mark on that character, hopefully an indelible mark. That's not for me to say. You know, that's not for me to decide, but hopefully it will be. But I've made some sort of mark on this character, and there's someone out there whose first exposure to the literary, at least the literary version of this character, will be this book. And I'm incredibly proud of that, and I'm incredibly honored that that's true.
Well, you should be proud of it. You did a great job. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Looks amazing. So when you were younger and you were getting into art, developing your skills, who were some of the artists that inspired you?
Oh, let me think. There's so many, but I think primarily I can sort of point to – there's in terms of the comic side, there's guys like Gene Colan, Bill Sienkiewicz, Alex Ross. Al Williamson was a big influence. I loved Al Williamson's work whenever a new Star Wars movie would come out and he would do the adaptation. Mm-hmm. I loved those more than the movies. I loved the movies, but then I grabbed those adaptations and just read the shit out of them all the time. Like, I just loved those books. I have a large format edition of The Empire Strikes Back, the original Marvel miniseries, which is just a beautiful thing to marvel and look at. And there were fine artists as well. My education was that of a fine artist. So it was Caravaggio, an Italian artist, post-Renaissance artist. Giuseppe Ribera, a realist from Spain. Vermeer, Garrett Du, not a lot of contemporary American illustrators, I have to say. But that's it's a lot. I kind of just look at every try to do the best I can emulating everything, and it's terrible. And then I look at it a year later and I'm like, oh, that's not bad. I can see. Yeah. I can see what I was going for.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's a struggle for the art. As you get older, I describe my experience. I feel like I do have a very identifiable approach, but I came by it honestly. I didn't sort of wake up one day when I was 20 and decide this is the way I'm going to draw. I sort of was interested in my early 20s. I was sort of interested in all these different styles. I'm going to pause you 1 second so my daughter can say something. What is it?
Okay.
Quick. Just give me 1 second to get my daughter something to eat.
No worries.
Well, I'm going to make you a sandwich.
Oh, well, that's mighty nice of you. I think I'll go with a grilled cheese. And while my good friend Dennis makes me that grilled cheese, let's take a moment to thank our Patreons who support our show and our endeavors. We couldn't do this without you.
White Rocket Entertainment.
Here at White Rocket, we want to give a big thanks to Nicholas Cottrell, Joseph Fine, Christopher Burleson, Samuel Salvatore, Phil Amthor of WeHaveDonuts.com, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Justin Bean, Chris Usher, David Evers, Tom Anderson, Timothy, Dan Thompson, Wes Adkinson, Steve Harlan, Andrew Barber, Gerard Albrich, Rich Reimer, Bill Matthews, Will Summerford, John McCune, Catherine England, Ann Congian, David Simpson, Josh Teal, Mike Finley, Randall Walker, C.T. Wayne, Earl Ricks, David Powell, Michael Kirshner, Mick Vigicana, Matt Robbenheimer, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, George Gaston, Tony Perry, Alex Gwynn, Clay Henson, J.W. Rice, Wardam Wade, Dave Medinas, Mark Squire, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Russell Milling, Rob Morgan, Steve Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Brant Rumble, Nicholas Craig, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, and Patrick Williams. Plus our one-time and anonymous donors. Folks, we really appreciate you supporting our program. Well, let's see if the little Miss Calero has gotten her sandwich and if Dennis is back with my grilled cheese. Are you back, Dennis?
And I'm back. All right, so where were we?
Hopefully you take this as a compliment that it's meant to be. When I look at your work, because I'm a big comic reader, so everything's kind of compared in the comic world, I see shades of, I mean, I may mispronounce his last name, but David Mazzucchelli from Batman Number One.
Interesting. No, that's not an insult at all.
Yeah, I mean it as a total compliment.
Yeah, people point things out, and I'm a big fan of that guy. And someone else pointed out once a while ago, they were like, I don't know why, I see a lot of Howard Chaykin in your work. And I'm like, well, I love Chaykin. So it could certainly be one of those things where you love a person's artwork so much that just naturally you're gravitating towards the same sort of solutions to problems. I find that happens with people. I work with a lot of artists as well and students, and I find that sometimes people start gravitating towards a certain approach without even knowing. I'm like, have you seen this person's work? And they're like, no, I never heard of that person. I'm like, well, you should check it out because you're barking up the same tree. You should be aware of how this person is solving problems, because it may have, you know, it may have an influence on how you. So it's interesting how it could happen in all different kinds of ways.
Definitely.
Yep. So not consciously, but I'll take it.
Yeah. And like I said, it's total compliment, I think.
I mean, I would say there's a sort of streamlined simplicity to Mazzucchelli's storytelling that I've always responded to. I've never been, even though I've enjoyed comics where the storytelling was a little bit more flashy or a little bit more unconventional, like a Walt Simonson, or, you know, that's very exciting for me to read. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff has never been exciting for me to draw. I've always preferred to sort of draw a story that unfolds in a more naturalistic way, if that makes sense.
No, yeah. That's just
what interests me. I was doing a job. I was illustrating a series of cans for it. So get this. So it was a London art director working with a design firm in Saudi Arabia that was designing fruit juice can designs for a company in India.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so it was great. So phone calls were fantastic. But it was fun. But it was a very cartoony style. My wife was like, oh, I didn't know you did this. I'm like, I kind of do a lot of stuff. It's just sort of what I do is sort of what interests me the most. But, you know, I can bend and sing in a different voice, so to speak, if I have to. It just feels natural. So I have what I think is an identifiable approach or a style, but I came by it honestly, I was saying, because it wasn't like I woke up when I was 20 and said, well, this is the way that I'm going to draw. Because I know guys like that. I know at school a lot of different guys, some were very successful, and some of them just sort of picked a style when they were like 18 or 19, and now that they're 40, they want to blow their brains out because they're so bored. They haven't evolved. Mm-hmm. I like to think that I was interested in a whole bunch of different kinds of things and sort of slowly developed. The way that I describe it is I became less interested in certain things. I sort of did a certain approach and then realized, well, I'm not really having fun with this. And little by little, I liken it to an arrow on a compass sort of going all over the place, but very slowly swaying and eventually stopping at true north. And that's how I felt about my development as an artist. Even though that development is, I'm still evolving, and my stuff is different than it was 5 years ago, I feel like I'm just doing what interests me rather than sort of trying to approach the page in a specific way. I just sort of approach the page my way. And it comes out the way it comes out.
No, that's great. That's great. I definitely feel you on that. Very, very cool. Very cool. When you're creating your 007 comic here, you're making Casino Royale, you've taken about a year to do it. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of art. What's your process like? Do you like to be alone? Do you like to have music on, podcasts, TV? Like, what's going on when you're drawing?
Sure, very specific. My process is very specific. First is layouts from the script. And in that situation, during that process, I like to have no noise. That's the part of the process that requires the most intense thinking, is figuring out how to tell the story, how the page is constructed, where the characters need to be. Some of that is a set of creative decisions based on what I feel like doing or what I feel like could be interesting or more interesting than the last version I just did. And part of it is just the requirements of the script. The person that speaks first generally is on the left side of the panel, and the person who speaks second is on the right. So constructing the story, there is an element of it that is just logistical, that is just sort of figuring out, well, I'm here, I'm in the space. And Van, what's nice is that Van is a very visual writer. A lot of times when I'm drawing a script from someone who's not an artist, there's a lot of reconstruction of the storytelling in terms of, well, I'm going to move that character there because I can't have these characters speaking back and forth five times in one panel. That doesn't work. And there's just as much of, well, these two panels where each character is saying one thing. This doesn't really have to be two panels. This is better if it's one. And I don't know about you. I know that you're an artist. For me, in terms of storytelling, I do find that the minimal number of panels to tell the story usually is the most interesting version. If I can find a way to take four panels and make them two, usually the trickery involved, assuming that the result is clear and the result is readable, assuming that, then the two panel version of the sequence is going to be visually more interesting because you're going to be playing more tricks in terms of the storytelling to carry the story further. And it's that tension of how much story can I tell in the minimal amount of images, I think, that actually makes it more pleasurable for the reader. I don't think readers really enjoy seven panels of people talking or three pages of someone walking down the stairs, unless, of course, there's a very specific narrative reason why you're taking this amount of time. Generally speaking, whether it's movies, books, or comics, I find that brevity really helps the process of enjoyment, because making it brief, as paring it down to the bone, making the storytelling as brief as possible to tell the story invariably will involve storytelling tricks and concepts that are going to intrinsically be interesting to the reader. That's been my experience.
I agree with that. I think that's great.
So that's the part of don't bother me, no music, no podcast. I need to sketch this out.
Right.
Then I collect reference, whether it's photographs that I take or if it's a location. I may grab something off the internet, whether I shoot models. Sometimes I'll actually hire a model. Sometimes I'll just shoot myself and sort of change the faces. You'll catch me playing characters. I like to play minor characters. I have a little bit of a theatrical background, and I do direct small projects. So I do like to sort of have that part of the reference collection be a little bit theatrical. When I was drawing a book called X Factor for Marvel, which is a team book, I was on there for 4 or 5 issues, and I actually had a group of friends that were each playing the individual characters. And so I would bring them back every month or so. I'd give them, you know, a pizza lunch, and we would just spend a couple of hours shooting reference. I don't do that necessarily because it's easier. It's just fun for me. I just enjoy it.
That is fun, yeah.
And also, I find that when I hire a model, especially if they have acting experience or training as an actor or actress, that they can bring something to the character that I didn't expect. I can describe right. the situation, have to read the script, and they'll play it a certain way. And I go, oh, it didn't even occur to me that that could be played that way. So that's always fun. And at that point, kind of collect everything together, and I do sort of these tight layouts, loose pencils, and then I just start, then I scan them in, and I just start embellishing on the computer using either Photoshop or Clip Studio, that kind of thing. And I'll bring in textures, and I'll do as much fooling around experimentation as the project and time will allow.
That's interesting, because when I was looking through your book, I was thinking, I see a lot of hand-done pencil and ink work here, but I feel like, I'm like, is this computer? Is this old school? But you're mishmashing. You're taking everything. Advantage of every layer. And I think that's really creates a unique and powerful look. You did a wonderful job with it.
Thank you. I mean, as far as digital, I mean, digital's here. And the technology, I use a Cintiq and a Mobile Studio Pro. And it is hand done in the sense that I'm inputting, you know, the sensory input is through my hand using, you know, various different brushes that I've either gotten from people or bought or adjusted for my own taste to mimic certain lines or whatever. I find when I stop and I go and I paint something, there's a period of adjustment. But there, you know, as an artist, if you're jumping from watercolor to oil or oil to pencil or from pencil to whatever, ceramics, there's always a period of adjustment anyway. So I just see the computer as one tool in the flow of things, which I can bounce from. When I'm doing a painting, I did a painting a couple of years ago for NASA, and I basically did a drawing. I collected a reference, did a drawing by hand, scanned it in, sort of did the mechanical parts of it. It was astronaut in a spaceship, basically, sort of in the future. Mm-hmm. So I did the mechanical stuff with Photoshop. Anything that you would normally sort of airbrush, I did with Photoshop because, you know, why break out the airbrush? Printed it on good paper, mounted it on Masonite with sort of clear, you know, crystal clear, painted it on top with oil, scanned it back in, and did some more touch-ups, and then I was done. And the computer was just one other tool in that workflow. Because as an illustrator, my feeling is that I'm my job is to get it done, do it well, and get it done as quickly as possible to move on to the next thing. That's my job. The experience of when I work in illustration, I work towards the experience of holding the book in your hand. The page on the board or the page in the computer, that's not the final product. The final product is the book in your hand. That's what I'm working towards. Now, if I'm doing something for gallery or you know, for a commission for someone wants a piece of art to hang in their wall, or someone wants something for a museum or something like that, or gallery piece, where the primary engagement is face-to-face, that's different.
Right.
And I think that's the way it should be. It's sort of like, in a way, whether the difference between shooting a film or staging a play. They're both engaging, but they both have completely different requirements. You can't stage a play the way you do a film, and you can't make a film the way you stage a play. It doesn't work. So I see that as analogous. You know, the differences are analogous to that.
Yeah, you have a very crystal clear way of explaining things. I like that.
Oh, thank you.
You use great examples.
I think about this stuff a lot. I'm trying to understand, because in the quest of doing things better, doing things faster, paring down to do my definition of success beyond a certain amount of money to be comfortable and to be able to provide an education for my daughter, yada, yada, yada. Beyond that, my definition of success is getting up and doing what I would do anyway if I didn't have to work. So in the quest for that, this is part of the process. Oh, there's a faster way for me to do this. Clip Studio, I remember when they introduced a perspective function. For those out there who aren't artists, professional artists, there's a piece of software called Clip Studio, which is basically a comic book software that streamlines a lot of these processes for us as artists. One function that it has is a perspective function, which lets you basically choose 3 perspective points, and then the computer will guide your hand, allowing you to use any tool and responding to the pressure of your hand to produce lines that vary in thickness according to what you want to do, but keeping it in perfect perspective. I remember this was a couple of years ago, a friend of mine wanted me to do a drawing of a city street for the mayor's office here in New York, in Manhattan. I opened up the software, I sort of set up my reference, I sort of set up my drawing, and I had this thing done in an hour or two in this incredibly complex three-point perspective. And I'm just like, you know, if you can get it done faster, it's a lot of concern among, I meet a lot of younger students or younger people coming up into this field. And there's a lot of concern about cheating. Is it cheating to use reference photographs? Is it cheating to use trace paper to transfer a drawing to a board? It's all cheating. It's a magic trick. It doesn't, you're creating a drawing that doesn't, you're creating the illusion of three-dimensional space. If you're a representational artist anyway, you're creating the illusion of three-dimensional space. It doesn't exist. It's marks on a page. It's a magic trick. At no point is my covenant with the reader that when you open the book, you'll be able to stick your hand through and all of these things exist in three-dimensional space. That's not the agreement. The agreement is that I will fool your eye and you will allow your eye to be fooled. And if I can fool your eye in a way that's effective and engaging, then it's succeeded. But the gauge of success is not creating reality. So given that, and that's all a magic trick, is it cheating for a magician to not be using actual supernatural powers? It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous idea. So what I always tell students is, if you don't get caught, then it's not cheating. Like if you use reference and it looks like you're using reference and it's stiff and I'm not perfect. I've had that problem. But if you're using it and it feels naturalistic and it feels engaging and it works for the reader, then you succeeded. How you got there doesn't matter, provided you're not wholesale stealing from someone. But, you know, but I swipe. I go, I'm not going to draw that building better than that. So I'm going to just grab that and just copy it and adjust it and fold it and make it my own. I forget if it was Neil Adams or Kirby, but someone said, don't draw what you can trace. Don't trace what you can swipe, and don't swipe what you can steal. Like, your job is to get the job done and to not look like you're cheating. But it's all a cheat. That's what I say. It's all cheating. Just don't get caught.
There you go. Now, speaking of, you mentioned that your work on was X Factor, I believe.
Yes.
The next question I have on my list, what other work that you've done outside of Bond are you most proud of?
I did a 4-issue miniseries for Marvel almost 10 years ago, not quite 10 years ago, called X-Men Noir, which I'm very proud of.
Nice.
And then me and Fred Van Lente, the writer on that project, did a second miniseries, which is great. So I'm very proud of that. Proud of the piece I did for NASA, which very few people saw, but it's outside of NASA, but it's one of my favorites. It's a lovely little painting that I'm very proud of. I do a online comic called Devil Inside with a writer and actor named Todd Stashwick, which is online and free, and I'm very proud of that as well. And, I'm living my best life, so I'm proud of that. I'm raising a great, great little girl. But my wife and I just bought a really nice house that we're really enjoying. I'm building out a tiki bar next to the studio. That's not a joke.
All right.
I'll send you photos when it's done.
Please do.
It's a day-to-day thing. I don't, I try not to focus. I'm very ambitious. I'm very competitive. So I try actually to keep that in check. There are definitely things that I still want to do. I wrote a pilot for Sci-Fi Channel. I was proud of having written that, even though it didn't get produced. But I'm proud of that accomplishment. I worked briefly on the Dark Tower movie before it was the current one that came out. I was proud of that work. Very proud of the work me and my friends did on that project. And I'm hoping to be proud of more stuff. I'm very proud of Casino Royale, and I'm hoping to keep making stuff I'm proud of.
What projects, if you can say, and I understand sometimes there's non-disclosure stuff, but do you got anything upcoming that you'd like to talk about? Anything on the horizon?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm constantly working on Devil Inside, my web comic with Todd Stashwick. You can find him at toddstashwick.com, toddstashwick.com. For a link to the web comic. It's free, no advertisement. We don't even ask for email address. We just ask that people, if you like it, say something about it on the Twitters or on the Instagrams or on the Facebooks. So that's always happening. Right now I'm working on a graphic novel with a guy named Dan Powell, who worked with Amy Schumer actually on her show, and he has directed a great independent film called Bex, and we're doing a science fiction graphic novel based on one of his concepts that I'm working on right now. And I'm also working on something for Humanoids. The European publisher is going to be doing some stuff in America, which I can't really talk about.
No,
but I'm looking forward to that. And I got to say, the response to Casino Royale has been fantastic. So me and Van are crossing our fingers. The script to Live and Let Die is done. So me and Van are crossing our fingers that we'll get the green light to do the next one. And hopefully maybe in the fall I'll be working on that.
Wow.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed for you, my friend. Well, you've made it. You've run the gauntlet of our questions.
And all right.
I appreciate you being on the show. I know this has been an extremely busy week for you with the book coming out, and I know you're in the middle of a move, and making time for us and the fans of the show really speaks to your character. So thanks for being here.
It's my deep pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. You got anything else? Any final parting words for the 007 family?
I hope that, like in other iterations, that our iteration of James Bond will return.
You can't do any better than that. Thanks for stopping by, Dennis. Dennis Calero, he's the artist on the new James Bond Casino Royale. It's in hardback right now and very affordable for a hardback, too. It's a great price.
It's the price. It's let's see. So real quick, 150 pages. That's about, let's see, five is 100. That's about seven. Almost eight issues of comics for $25. That's less than buying single issues on the newsstand. That would run you $32 to $40 if it was, you know, floppy. So this is a deal.
Cover price $24.99. You know, I know you bargain hunters can go out there and find it for cheaper if you do.
Sure.
But either way, let's get some money into Dennis's coffers for this hard work here. Go out and buy some copies. Make sure you get some nice residual checks out of this thing.
Awesome.
Thanks for being here, Dennis.
Thank you.
You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Like to give one more big thank you to Dennis Calero for being on our show here today. We really appreciate that. We also appreciate the hard editing work that our good friend Pat Sampson puts into making these shows. Pat is one of our co-hosts right here on the On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast Network. He is one of our rookie agents on MI6 Rookie Agents, and he does a lot of editing for us. He also has his own show called The Long Box Crusade. You should definitely check that out if you're into comics. And since we had a comic-oriented guest here today, you might, you know, if that's a crossover for you, you might want to check that out. So thanks again to Dennis for being here and Pat for editing the show for us. We couldn't do it without you. Remember, On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast will return.
I'll send you pictures of my tiki bar once it's done.